number 07-72. MPD Reserve Officer L. Appellant versus Carl Frank. Ms. Comandi for the appellant, Ms. Johnson for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors, if it pleases the court. I'm Matthew LaFondi. I represent the Reserve Officers Daniel Kim, Christopher Griffith. This matter comes before the court on an appeal of the summary dismissal of their complaint against the previous Chief of Police, Charles Ramsey. In regards to rulemaking in the guise of a general order that was proclamated by the under his signature by the District of Columbia Metropolitan Police in 2006, which included a prohibition of the right to organize for collective bargaining. We assert that this amounts to a improper prior restraint of rights of free association and free speech that are inherent in the ability of these officers to meet and discuss their grievances with the organization for which they provide a great deal of services.
Meet and discuss with each other, or meet and discuss with representatives of the D.C. government?
Right, and that is an important distinction.
Right to.
That's an important distinction.
To require government to come to the table, right to petition, yes, but not a right, as far as I know, to do anything except, I guess, allow the petitions to come in under the door.
Right, Judge Williams, and that is a very, very important distinction here. As the prohibition is written, it prohibits them from organizing for the purpose of collective bargaining.
Well, that's a conceivable reading.
I'm sorry?
I said that's a conceivable reading. In context, it seems the less probable reading.
I think that's important.
About benefits and what benefits the reserve officers are entitled to. And anyone in America would think of the right to talk about some change in program as a benefit.
In Joint Appendix 16, and this is the very last paragraph, which is the offending section that the reserve officers complain of, it says, except as provided for in the district personnel manual, these reserve officers shall not be eligible for these benefits or the right to organize for collective bargaining unless such benefits are specifically provided by the laws of the District of Columbia. So it references this personnel manual section as enabling, potentially, this conduct. But it doesn't say that it somehow modifies or inhibits conduct within that section. It says that unless that section provides it, it cannot occur.
Well, the question is, what's the it?
The organizing.
So it says such unless such benefits are specifically provided, and as I said, I think it would be an unusual American who regarded the right to talk about trying to change some government program as a benefit.
No, we assert that it's a not the benefit, it is a right to...
Well, then, but then why do you think the word benefits encompasses it?
It's inartfully drafted, but the mechanics of it are that it inhibits that right.
Suppose you get an opinion saying that court doesn't see any reason to think that the correct interpretation of this provision would stand in the way of all the talk and association that the officers want to do.
I think that interpretation will be to their benefit, because that would resolve the issue.
That, I believe, is the interpretation advocated by the district.
No, the district's interpretation is that unless a statute provides for it, they cannot associate. They cannot speak.
They can't have collective bargaining. They can't force the government to the table.
We've never asked for that. We have conceded from the beginning that there's no obligation for them to accept the organization, but by a plain reading of this section, it's inhibiting their right to get together, speak their mind, formulate a petition, and attempt to redress their grievances. And the briefs of the defendant clearly cite that there's no right to do that beyond simply having the government hear them. They say they don't have the right to organize. They don't have the right to speak together.
What does the government brief say? I mean, here, page 14, four lines from the bottom, denying volunteers only the right to force the district to act.
Going back to 9 and 10 of their brief, towards the bottom of 10, oh, I'm sorry, 11. It's this bundle of statutory benefits creating an affirmative right to compel a district to negotiate. It constitutes this benefit. Again, because if you look in the middle of that paragraph there, the provision does not bar volunteers from organizing for other purposes, lobbying the legislature, to grant them a right. It's clear right there, that language. This would be the third sentence on 11 in the middle paragraph, that the government is intent on prohibiting the organization for that purpose.
For which purpose?
Collective bargaining. It says it.
Well, I don't know.
I'm
not sure exactly what "for other purposes" means in that sentence, but
I'm talking about the second part of that sentence. It says, "such as lobbying the legislature, a right to collective bargain."
Right. So they're saying that's fine.
Yeah, but that's not what this says. That is not what this says. It says, again, they're going back to this point that, which was in their original motions for summary judgment or motions for dismissal, that there must be a statutorily conferred right to organize for the purpose of collective bargaining. This is where they cited Henry Debs, stating that collective bargaining was a criminal conspiracy. And
I'm sorry, where is Debs cited?
JA 195. This is echoing their argument that was made to the district court. Starting on 194.
I'm sorry, 194?
194 of the joint appendix. They're trying to gloss over this at this point, but it's still here. Count one of the complaint asserts correctly the new general order does not permit reserve officers to organize for collective bargaining purposes. In plaintiff's view, this is a deprivation of a liberty interest and amounts to a deprivation of constitutional rights of free speech and free association. Now, they gloss over this on appeal to say, we have the ability to self-regulate. We have the ability to limit our own conduct so that it doesn't infringe upon the right for them to meet in their own homes. But they have not, as shown, page 11 of the brief, they have not gotten away from this idea that the right to organize for collective bargaining must be statutorily conferred. That it is, that the general order is prohibits them from this conduct, and if they want to go change the statute, that's fine. So there it is. I'm sorry.
It prohibits this conduct in the sense that you can't force the district to enter into collective bargaining negotiations with you because there's no statute giving you that right.
That's correct. That's the distinction.
Not that you can't do everything else. I mean, you can organize, as it were, for collective bargaining, but the district doesn't have to come to the table.
It's clearly an opposite to what they've previously cited. It's clearly on 194 of the joint appendix. It's clearly an opposite to that sentence on page 11. They're glossing over this issue that the district court relied upon. That
I know you want to read that to say the contrary of what I said, but another way to read that is saying that you want to organize for collective bargaining purposes such that the District of Columbia will be forced to enter into negotiations with you over terms and conditions of employment.
We have expressly said the opposite repeatedly. That we
what exactly do you want? So I'm clear.
So that these folks can get together, they can put themselves in an organization. There was a prior organization, it was called the Reserve Officers Action Committee, where these people would meet and say, there's a problem here. And to understand
Give me a specific. In other words, they would meet and say, we think we're getting inadequate training on how to use a particular
weapon. Huge issue.
All right. So suppose they meet and they agree on that, and they say, we think this training is inadequate.
Then what they did from there.
Now, you're saying the district is interpreting, quote, the law, close quote, not to enable them to get together and reach that conclusion?
It expressly.
And then write the chief and say, this training is inadequate?
It expressly says so in their prior brief at 194.
Has the district ever, in fact, acted on this?
Yes.
How?
Prior to the enactment of this general order, the proclamation of this general order, there was this prior organization that these reserve officers were involved, this organization, vociferously pushing the police department, trying to meet with them, writing the letters, setting up the meetings, complaining to the other authorities such as the DC Council to prompt them into action. This was prior to this enabling legislation.
I understand, but, and maybe the district, what did the chief say or the district official said they weren't going to meet with these officers about
they
this?
They did on occasion meet with these officers.
But did they ever say that the officers didn't have the right to submit their concerns?
No, what happened instead was there was instead retaliation. There was petty efforts to exclude persons from programs. There was efforts to keep people from being promoted or transferred or enjoying specialized training. And it was as a part of this pressure, this conflict between the group that were organizing and trying to pressure the district, the Metropolitan Police Department into doing these things, that the response from the district was to, or from the defendant, was to write this general order. It says there will be no more of that. And I think, while Judge Williams is quite correct, that the majority of the argument that's within the appellee's brief talks about, well, they have no right to have their grievances heard, there still remains this position, which is that they will intrude upon the organization itself.
They will what?
Intrude upon. They will infringe upon the right for that free association, for that free speech. And the suggestion, considering the prior history, that they will somehow self-regulate, which is clearly in opposite to the case law, where, as for instance, Virginia v. Hicks, 539, United States Reporter, 118-119, punishes a substantial amount of protected free speech judged in relation to the statute's plainly legitimate suite, suffices to invalidate all enforcement.
Do you know of any case that's been filed by a volunteer on the grounds that there's been a First Amendment violation because, I mean, I'm trying to think of a hypothetical within your description. This volunteer brought certain issues to the attention of an official, and the allegation is that as a result, this official demoted that person in rank or anything like that. In other words, you're making a facial challenge on this general order and these emergency regulations which no longer exist.
Yes, because this is a prior restraint. This is a blanket prior restraint, and the suggestion that all of the cases cited with regards to the facial challenge of the that were cited by the defendant dealt really with ex post facto, went after the enforcement of those, and as cited by the Supreme Court in Nebraska Press Association 42 United States 539 at 559, the prior restraints are the most serious and the least tolerable.
But we would have to find that there's no interpretation of that order that could be consistent with First Amendment rights to strike it down.
Well, that's in opposite, again, to the case I just cited a moment ago that states in Virginia v. Hicks that if it punishes the legitimate speech, it must be invalidated entirely. And that
if,
is if that's
gets
us
the
to,
only way to interpret it. If it
that's the interpretation
in a way
that, the,
that it doesn't impinge upon First Amendment rights, then
I
your
don't know
facial
how,
challenge can't succeed.
I don't know how the court could suggest that the defendant interprets it any other way upon reading Joint Appendix 194,
okay,
which is, correctly, the general order does not permit reserve officers to organize for collective bargaining purposes. Mm-hmm. Asserts correctly. That is their interpretation. They share that interpretation with us. They gloss over it on appeal.
They're not going to sit down at the table with you and negotiate. That's what that page 194 says.
No, it says that we're prohibited from organizing.
for purposes of collective bargaining where the district is forced to sit at the table and talk to you about terms and conditions.
That language isn't there.
Your activity. Well, what else could it mean?
If someone said exactly what happened in the Reserve Action Committee, where these people got together.
And you're and telling me that there were retaliation occurred.
Absolutely.
People complained.
Absolutely.
And I asked you whether there was any case brought by someone who alleged that they had suffered such retaliation as a result of the exercise of First Amendment rights.
Yes, and that case was an unpublished opinion by the D.C. Court of Appeals.
That's the Johnson case.
No, not the Johnson case. The LaFondi case at 233 of the Joint Appendix, which at length detailed all sorts of retaliation that occurred, expressly dealing with the Reserve Action Committee. Yes, I was.
Yes.
And until I was a reserve officer for some 15 years, and so for this reason, I'm rather intimately familiar with the goings on here. I also the person that played a role in the drafting of the enabling legislation that that is at issue here today. So, in this case, I outlined a very detailed set of facts that said we had that this retaliation occurred because that this organization for collective bargaining was going on. Now, a termination of the services occurred without a hearing, which goes on to the next issue, which was subsequently withdrawn to pull the rug out from under the cause of action. If you look at 235, it's at the second, third paragraph, it describes that there was a process ex post facto that was given, and then I was reinstated subsequently, and the court says that LaFondi received the process to which he was entitled, and that left me with the other claim, which was a claim under the Whistleblower Protection Act. This was a D.C. statutory cause of action. What the court found there correctly was that the WPA fell solely within the Civil Merit Protection, the Comprehensive Merit Protection Act, to which a non-civil service employee was not entitled.
Okay, but this is a due process claim that you raised in that case, right?
With regards to retaliation over a First Amendment issue, specifically dealing.
Where is the First Amendment mentioned? That's what I was looking for.
Well, it was inherent in the whistleblower claim. I mean, this was pleaded as a D.C. stat. This was brought before.
I mean, there's a difference between a statutory claim and a First Amendment claim.
But a whistleblower claim obviously is predicated upon a First Amendment claim. And in a subsequent action before the U.S. District Court, which was subsequently settled, it was brought as a 1983.
All you argued was that your rights under the whistleblower statute were violated.
Correct. And then there was a subsequent D.C. District Court case that was brought and subsequently settled that was a First Amendment 1980-42 okay. United States Code 1983 claim. So
do we have that in the joint appendix?
I don't believe so. That's an issue that was
okay.
Because there was no since it was settled at that point in mediation.
You have to be careful though here in terms of what has been raised before and what hasn't been raised, and I still don't find where you're saying I asked you for an as-applied case on a First Amendment ground, and we still don't have any such opinion denying your claimed First Amendment rights.
No, there was no because that came. You asked me if that occurred, if there was such a claim was made. Two such claims were made. First of all, the original one predicated upon the Whistleblower Protection Act, which we assert is inherently a First Amendment claim. And the second one was specifically a First Amendment claim under 42 United States 1980, United States Code 1983 before the district court here and was subsequently settled. So we don't have any opinion that's related to that. Similarly to the D.C. case, the District of Columbia, once these issues were raised, was quick to capitulate and return the member back to service. And as a result, that matter was not fully adjudicated. But the claim was, in fact, made.
I just have one question about the due process issue. Can you point to any provision of the D.C. Code that appears to treat the Reserve Officer Corps as a part of the police force?
That's a very good question. And the way the code...
I just need section numbers.
Okay, well, we start off with Title V, which deals specifically with the police department. If we're getting on to the due process claim, we're talking about 5127.01, which says that any person within the police department, within the police force. Now, this brings up an important issue that I need.
A way of construing that would be to see whether there are portions of the code where the reserve officers are treated as part of the police force.
I need to lay some foundation to that to get there. In that, this organization has not started, did not, at its inception, it was not the same as what it is today. This organization has evolved over a very long period of time, and throughout the District of Columbia's history, there has been no provision whatsoever for this standing force of police officers. These folks wear the same uniform. They wear the same badge of authority.
I understand.
Yeah, but
that,
there's no provision for it. It never existed.
Right, right.
The only provision was under...
The due process point turns on the proposition that D.C. statutory law creates an entitlement. The 127.01 would, if it applies, but I'm trying to see if there's anything in the context that suggests that it does apply. Context being other provisions of the D.C. Code.
And I think you have to look at the cause for this code. What is the reason this code is here? And that's discussed in the brief, that you have these folks operating, you know, the defendant will say that these members are not sworn officers. They seem to hinge a lot of their argument upon this suggestion that these volunteer members are not sworn officers, which cannot be supported by the facts or the law. You cannot have a person put on the Metropolitan Police Department uniform, display the badge of authority of the District of Columbia, put their hand up and say that they will defend the Constitution and apprehend violators of the law, protect life and property, put them in a police car on patrol in the district.
All this may be true as an abstract matter, but the question is whether the D.C. legislature has created the entitlement on which you rely.
If the District of Columbia has not done that, then the actions that they are taking are completely unlawful on behalf of the District of Columbia. These folks cannot make a warrantless arrest under 23581, 582, District of Columbia Code, arrest without warrant by a law enforcement officer, unless they are the sworn personnel of the police department.
What about citizen arrests?
That's 582, arrest without warrant by other persons, which is limited to felonies and the list of 15 enumerated probable cause misdemeanors for an offense which occurs in their presence.
What about this Volunteer Services Act, which seems to relate to any services of any person on a voluntary basis. Is there anything that takes this Reserve Corps out of that? Because that says, shall be at the discretion of each agency and shall be discontinued by the agency at any time for any reason and shall not give rise to any right or process of appeal.
Absolutely. Until you have the standing force of police officers to which that DC code is applicable. And the reason it's applicable is because if these officers are going to go out on the street and exercise discretionary police duties, I'm going to arrest this person, I'm not going to arrest that person.
I need to stop you. Just answer, are you saying the Volunteer Services Act, these regulations I just read, do apply to the Reserve Force? They do not. All right, and where in the code does it exempt them from the definition or description of the services of any person on a voluntary basis?
It is 512701, which says no person shall be removed from the police department because they have to be protected. The opposite result would be that there would be this identical cadre, this uniformed force of armed police officers who are completely beholden to political influence. That the mayor, the chief of police, by exercising this section of the Volunteer Services Act to remove these people at any time, can say, I don't want you to arrest that person. That person has committed a crime in my presence. I am obligated under District of Columbia law to arrest that person. You do that and we will fire you. This is what I was talking about in the Lexow Commission at the turn of the 20th century in New York City, and the amount of corruption and cronyism and politicism that was going on in the New York City Police Department. And the first step that the police commission took was to remove that political element from its uniformed officers.
All right, let me stop. If anyone has no more questions, you're way over your time. So, Judge Williams, you have to get we'll give you a few minutes. Johnson?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Holly Johnson, and I represent the District of Columbia defendants, Chief Charles Ramsey and Chief Kathy Lanier. In this case, the reserve officers are bringing a facial challenge to a general order that incorporates two provisions that have had the full force of the law for almost 30 years. The limitation on collective bargaining and the denial of career service protections have been in effect as part of the Volunteer Services Act regulations since 1979. Despite this, the reserve officers have alleged no injury arising out of these provisions and have not alleged in their complaint a single instance in which their free speech was chilled as a result. With regard to the First Amendment claim, there's only two routes in which you can bring a facial challenge to a provision based on the First Amendment. Either the reserve officers must show that the collective bargaining provision could never be applied in a valid manner, or they must show that the provision provides a substantial risk that its application will lead to the suppression of speech. And in this case, neither of those situations are present. With regard to the constitutionally valid interpretation, I think this court adequately understands the district's interpretation of the provision. The most likely interpretation of this collective bargaining provision is that volunteers, by virtue of being volunteers, do not share in statutory benefits that are generally granted to district employees, and therefore volunteers are not granted a right normally accruing to employees to force the district to engage in collective bargaining. The reserve officers may very well conceptually argue that perhaps the regulation could be interpreted in a manner that might infringe on free speech. But that's not their burden of proof in a facial challenge. That's not what they need to prove. They need to prove that it can't be interpreted in a constitutional manner, and clearly here it can. I would like to address briefly Mr. LaFondi's argument regarding the district's argument below. First, I would like to note that clearly legal argument made in the district court has no bearing on this court. That's why these arguments, unless they have relationship to a waiver argument or some sort of procedural argument, are not generally put in an appendix. They don't tend to have any effect here. But also, certainly, perhaps that argument wasn't as artfully phrased as the one made on the appellate brief, but certainly the same idea was posed there, which is that the district can't be forced to sit at the table and collectively bargain with the reserve officers the way it can be forced to do so with employees, but the regulation doesn't infringe on any free speech rights. I also want to address Mr. LaFondi's assertions that the district has acted on this provision and has retaliated against reserve officers in response to their efforts to associate with each other and raise issues of common concern. Initially, this is a facial challenge. This is a motion to dismiss based on the complaint. These allegations are not in the complaint. The complaint does not contain a single as-applied allegation or challenge. Furthermore, if we did look into the LaFondi case, which has been decided by the D.C. Court of Appeals, if you look at the allegations in that decision by the D.C. Court of Appeals, it says that Mr. LaFondi complained about certain matters that he believed should have been handled better by the police force. It doesn't say anything about association. I can give you the page number. If you look at the bottom of page JA-233 and the top of 234, Mr. LaFondi threatened to make reports for failing to provide protective gear, for complaining about the response to September 11th, and that's the only fact assertion about complaints. It says nothing about association. It says nothing about collective bargaining. It says nothing about meeting, speaking, anything like that. And again, it wasn't a First Amendment claim. And of course, at its core, there's no such allegation in the complaint. I'm not familiar with the 1983 claim that Mr. LaFondi refers to. However, I will note that he said that it was settled, and as such, he certainly has waived any right to raise that here as a member of this purported class. But this court need not get into any of these matters. It looks at the four corners of the complaint. The complaint doesn't contain any assertion of an as-applied challenge. Throughout this litigation, all the way up through the reply brief, this has been treated as a facial challenge, and this court should treat it as such.
Help us out on the due process.
That's what I'm moving to, Your Honor. Thank you. I believe it's clear from the reserve officer's argument previously that their entire basis for a due process right, it hinges on the interpretation of Section 5-127.01. And before I get into the interpretation of that, I just would want to again point out that in order to have a due process right, it can't simply be something that the reserve officers think is a good idea, even if they think there are very strong policy considerations for a due process right. Those reasons need to go to the council and not before the court. In Board of Regents v. Roth, this court, the Supreme Court stated that you have to have a legitimate claim of entitlement based on state law. And in 2003, in Block v. Powell, this court said that the statutory language, there must be explicitly mandatory language in the statute guaranteeing a right to, in order to have a due process right.
5-127-1, if it applies, would seem to do that.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah.
I think that
the only question is whether it applies.
That's correct. That's correct. So getting into the details of 5-127-01, the statute was passed in 1901. And has been amended only once since then. In 1901, it provided what you see as the initial block of the statute, giving career service protection to officers or members of the MPD. And then it says, provided that no person shall be removed, essentially without cause. It has a lot of language, but that's essentially what it says. This statute was amended in 1906. And there was a new clause which falls at the very end of the statute that denies this very for-cause termination protection to the volunteer members of the force that were volunteers at that time. Now, in 1906, there was no Reserve Corps. There was what I would assume would be the the first iteration of what is now the reserve corps. It certainly evolved into something much more. But in 1906, there was a provision in the law allowing for special police officers or special privates, and they were, at the time, the only volunteer members of the police force. And you can see that I've actually attached code provisions from 1901 and 1906 describing what the composition of the police force was, and those were the only volunteers at the time. Now, the police officer's argument for statutory entitlement rests on the word person. And essentially what the police reserve officers argue is, we're people, we're a person, and therefore we must be included in this language. But with the 1906 amendment, it becomes very clear that the word person is not intended to mean every human being who serves the police force. At that time, the clause excluding the volunteer members clearly meant that at that time, the word person didn't include volunteers. So it would follow that the word person now cannot be explicit enough to create career service protection for volunteers, especially in light of the fact that there's a regulation explicitly denying such protection. Now, the reserve officers in their reply brief essentially give three responses to this. First, they devote several pages to explaining that special police are now private security officers. And that is true. The word special police, as the reserve corps came about and the special police officers stopped being used in the volunteer sense, I guess the word special police was reused. So if you looked at the code provisions about special police now, they do not refer to the volunteers. But when we're interpreting what the lawmakers intended to confer in 1901 and 1906, we look at what the word meant back then. And back then, the word special police were the only volunteer police officers. Secondly, the reserve officers argue that because they did not exist in 1906, Congress could not have intended to exclude them from the Section 5-12701 when they re-added the clause in 1906. And what they say is that in 1906, Congress never envisioned a permanent standing force of volunteer officers. And the district's response is simply that if Congress didn't envision the existence of the reserve officers back then, they could not have intended to give those reserve officers career service protection. Again, career service protection isn't something that you fall into by accident. It has to be mandated by law. It has to be something that Congress intended to give.
If the Reserve Officer Corps fitted the meaning of the language chosen by Congress, it wouldn't make any difference what individual members of Congress had in mind.
Certainly not what individual members of Congress had in mind. I mean, that's certainly true.
But your argument turns on the notion that Congress used a set of words for the volunteers then known, and you think logically that those words should apply to the current type of volunteer.
I'm not sure that that clause at the very end referring to special police specifically applies to the Reserve Corps.
No, I understand.
But it certainly refutes. Yes.
You're saying that it suggests that there was no congressional intent,
yes,
to wrap up volunteers, however they might be designated.
Yes, it certainly refutes the reserve officer's argument that the word person, which is sort of an amorphous word, necessarily includes them. The reserve officers originally argued that the regulations, the trial board regulations by MPD and the original general order from 1995 created career service protection. They do appear to have abandoned this argument. They didn't refer to it again in their reply, so I would rest on my brief with regard to that.
The argument introduced an oral argument a few minutes ago that 23.581 indicates that they must be included.
Well, I'll be honest with you, Your Honor, I haven't heard that argument before today, and I haven't looked at those codes. But I would suggest that in 1906, if you look at the code provision allowing for special police officers to serve for the limited time that they served, at the time that they served, they had the full police powers as the career service officers, and yet they were excluded from career service protection. So perhaps what the resolution of this law would be that perhaps reserve officers can't actually make arrests, if indeed there is a conflict in the law, and I don't believe there is one. But I don't believe you can take a conflict in the law and create career service protection out of it.
Could I ask, what about provisions in the DC code that define personnel and that state expressly, with regard to the Reserve Corps, that it shall have as its membership a corps of unpaid volunteers.
You're referring to the new statute that was passed in 2004?
That's 5129.51B.
Yes, yes. And that certainly, I don't think that this was untrue before the statute was passed, but the statute certainly cements the position that the Reserve Corps are not intended to be something different than volunteers. It specifically refers to them as unpaid volunteers. And then if you go to the Volunteer Services Act, that defines volunteers as unpaid persons that provide services free of charge to the District of Columbia. So if anything, it cements the district's position that the Volunteer Services Act not only now applies to the Reserve Corps, but that it always has applied to the Reserve Corps. And perhaps the Reserve Corps members weren't aware of the collective bargaining limitation and even the at-will employment clause or the at-will volunteer status clause in the volunteer services regulations prior to the general order, which just recited these provisions and put them in the general order. But certainly they've been in existence for 30 years, and no harm has befallen any reserve officer member as a result. And again, the bottom line comes down to what the complaint alleges. And the complaint came in with many causes of action that have fallen by the wayside at this point. But the two causes of action that are before this court are a facial contestation of the regulation limiting collective bargaining and a challenge to the at-will status of volunteers. And when you look at the complaint and what's alleged there, you can see that they certainly haven't presented any substantial or real risk that their rights in any way will be chilled or that they in any time had a due process right prior to this. Therefore, if there are no further questions, the district defendants ask that this court affirm the trial court's ruling.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
I'd like to turn the court's attention to page 19 of the amended reply brief. The defendant's counsel has cited that back in 1906 that there were these special privates who were appointed for short periods of time as part of the what I termed as the posse comitatus. I do want to point out that 512903 perpetuates this particular code section, and that almost identical to the original 1878 law, where the mayor may draw upon ordinary citizens to serve as special privates for a specified time, and that these special privates, possess the powers and privileges of the standing police force. Obviously, this code section and the 1906 amendment, which addressed the inapplicability of these special privates appointed for a term, has nothing to do with the standing force of reserve officers that is present today, where these folks can serve for some 30 years at a time. They actually may retire from the Metropolitan Police Reserve Corps after their years of service. We've had members that have died in the performance of their duty, and they perpetuate all of the indicia of authority of a standing force of the police department. And if the defendant is permitted to arbitrarily remove these people from service, it compromises the legitimacy and the efficacy of the entire police department by having this political cadre interjected into a civil service organization that's regulated by law. And as it's plainly points evident in the present code section for 5.127.01, this language that any persons would be excluded from this due process provision is simply not there. It's absent. It was there in 1906. It's not there today. Obviously, the issue was addressed previously, and then it was excised for some reason. And we assert, for good reason, that this protection prevents corruption, prevents cronyism, nepotism, politicism, that if these folks determine that someone close to somebody politically powerful has committed some crime, they may apprehend that person. That is exactly the sort of thing that the Lexow Commission was having so much trouble with in New York City at the end of the 19th century, is that these folks were politically entrenched, that if they did not do the bidding of the local party bosses, they would be removed from service. And once Commissioner Roosevelt came in as president of the police commission in 1895, they said, no, if you're doing your job, if you apprehend somebody who's breaking the law, we will protect you from undue disciplinary action and retaliation for not doing a politician's bidding. And to create this situation by making an unnatural and unsupported construction of 5-12701 to say that these people are not persons as part of the police force is placing the District of Columbia in imminent danger of reverting back to a time when a police force was lawless and ineffective.